morning. This morning's reading is taken from Matthew, which is the first book of the New Testament. And if you'd like to follow along, it begins on page 1502. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." "Get up and take the child and his mother to go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. It's the word of the Lord.
Well, great to see everybody here this morning. Hope you had a great Christmas holiday. I'm still getting used to the idea of working on Christmas Eve, but I'm getting used to it. Actually, this year on Christmas Eve, right before the 10 o'clock service, I showed up a little bit early, and Jeremy Meekly and David Meekly and I decided we wanted to go get milkshakes, and we had some extra time, so we set out to go find milkshakes, and we weren't very successful. You'd be surprised how hard it is to find a milkshake on Christmas Eve, especially in just a few minutes. But eventually we found something in a 7-Eleven. It was like a Cold Stone Creamery wannabe milkshake. It was really just a very unfulfilling process. But anyway, So my point is, when stuff like that happens, especially on Christmas, you tend to never really forget those crazy Christmas stories. I'm sure when I say crazy Christmas stories, you probably have some of your own. And because they happen on Christmas, just for whatever reason, we don't forget them. They tend to stick with us forever. Like I remember one year, my dog ran away on Christmas Eve, and chasing after her, my dad nailed his knee on a tree stump because it was dark. You know. I remember my aunt, my great aunt, lip-syncing Santa Baby in front of our entire family, and I was really, really young. That's one of my oldest Christmas memories. But you know, whether they're crazy or not, you tend to not forget that stuff if it happens on Christmas, you know. And this morning, what I want to do, my goal this morning, is to get you to see something that really I only realized the past 2 years, and it's how crazy the Christmas story actually is. How borderline ridiculous and absurd the Christmas story is. We've heard it so many times that my fear is that it seems like another story that we just read through or we listen to year after year, and it has totally lost its impact. You know, it seems cute, you know, a baby born in a stable and with a virgin birth and all that, but really, if you'll step back and almost pretend you've never heard it before, it is one crazy Christmas story. We're in a series right now called All in the Family. And the series is covering the first few chapters of Matthew, chapters 1 and 2. And Pastor Josh started speaking on the first week, and he talked about the genealogy of Jesus, which was surprisingly interesting. You know, when you say genealogy, most people don't scoot to the edge of their seat. You know, it's usually the part that we skip when we're reading the Bible. Pastor Josh talked about the women in the genealogy of Jesus and what that tells us about him. And then the next week we talked about the two fathers of Jesus, the fact that Jesus had obviously God, his Father in heaven, but then also just a random carpenter named Joseph, and what a privilege that was. And on Christmas Eve, we continued the series, and we learned about the wise men or the magi, these people that traveled from far away to come see Jesus. And my job this morning is to cover the passage that Henry just read a minute ago, the second part of chapter 2. But to really understand the magnitude of what's happening here in the second half of chapter 2, of what Matthew wants us to know in writing his gospel, we need to see the big picture of the Christmas story, and we need to actually understand what a crazy, crazy story it is. It starts with this idea that we've already mentioned several times this morning, this idea of Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. The fact that God in heaven, this being that is, you know, outside of time, all powerful, in one sense we can understand him, in so many other senses, we can't. He's huge, he's amazing, he can do anything, and he decides that he's gonna become a human being. A human being. Like, there's billions of us, and he decides he's going to just become one. Jesus was around for about 30 years, 33 years, roughly, and that makes him just a blip on a timeline. And God decided he wanted to come and be one of these insignificant people. It's crazy. It's crazy to think about. You ever go to a concert or a football game or someplace where you're in an arena, and you just look around at all the people around you, and it's just, you just feel so small and insignificant. And God wanted to become one of those small, insignificant people. It's just crazy. It's crazy to think about. If it were me, I would want to distinguish myself in some way. If I were God, you know, coming to earth, I'd want to live for, you know, at least 1,000 years. So I'd be around for a while and everybody know, here I am, I'm God, and I'm here on earth. Or I'd want to be like, you know, 15 feet tall or something crazy like that. I don't know, maybe it's just a height thing, but... or my hair would be like long and made of gold or something... would communicate the fact that I am God and I'm taking the form of one of you measly little people. And yet Jesus, he was born to just an average Joe. He only lived 30 something years. He became one of us. God just became a man, Emmanuel. That's crazy, and that's how we start this crazy Christmas story. Well, then we meet a woman named Mary. I'm sure you've heard of her before. And she has this experience with an angel. And I imagine that experience was like amazing. I've never met with an angel before, but she has this conversation almost. And the angel tells her, you're going to give birth to somebody who's going to change the world. Jesus, the Savior. And I imagine in that moment it was like, wow, this is incredible. It's heaven here on earth. There's an angel speaking to me. This is going to be amazing. But then the angel left. And at that point, I feel like reality must have hit in a really difficult way. You see, society then was not like society now. Somebody who was pregnant outside of marriage could have been killed. They could have stoned her, where they would literally put her up against a wall and people would line up with big rocks and throw them at her until she died. Or she could be brought out into the town square in front of all the elders and the significant people and they would just publicly humiliate her, make her sin public so everybody knew. And she would lose her friends. She'd be a disgrace to her family. In fact, Roman law, she was living under the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire gave her father permission to kill her if he wanted to. You see, because normally when you're a virgin and you're pregnant, you're also a liar. So people didn't really buy this whole, okay, you're pregnant miraculously story. And this is the way God makes his grand entrance onto earth. It's crazy to think about. She would have lost her husband. She could have been disowned by her father. And in that culture, a woman couldn't just go out and get a job like she could today. That would have left her as a single mother with no way to provide for her family. So, Joseph finds out that she's pregnant, and like any respectable man back then, he breaks off this engagement. It's just what you did. And he even went out of his way to do it quietly because he didn't want to humiliate her that much, but he decides he's going to leave her. And then, if you know the story, you know that miraculously God meets him in a dream, an angel meets him and says, no, you can take Mary to be your wife, that she's telling the truth. And he does. And we think, oh, that's great. But you know, now we've also got Joseph in an interesting situation here. Because now Joseph, when you look at Joseph, you either think, well, there's a guy who's just as bad as Mary, because he's committed a sin that's just as bad as hers. Or he's somebody who's now fathering the child of an adulteress. That's not something that was respected back then. It wasn't something you did. As a Jewish man, your lineage was incredibly valuable. These men, it was such a big deal to have descendants. That's why we have all those genealogies in the Bible, because that was something you were proud of. So you didn't just go and father a child that wasn't yours. So here we have Mary and Joseph, and both their reputations are just ruined. Their image is just totally shot. They're now seen as rejects, as outcasts, as rebels. And remember, this is the way God decides to become a human being. This is his grand entrance. It's crazy. And then Mary, the pregnancy continues. Mary's in her third trimester, and the government requires that all men go back to their hometown, where or the place that they had grown up, because there was a census. So Joseph now has to travel from Nazareth to Bethlehem. That's an 80-mile journey. Most scholars and historians believe that Mary would not have had to go with Joseph. Only Joseph had to go back. But Mary decides to go with him. In her third trimester, as a pregnant woman, she decides to take an 80-mile journey on the back of a donkey. That would have taken 4 days. It would have been cold at night. It would have been dangerous. They could have been robbed. They could have been killed. This wasn't an easy thing. Have you ever taken a road trip to Florida? You know, maybe you know people that went for their Christmas break or whatever, and the conversation was like, oh, hey, yeah, we're going to Florida. Oh, that's great. How are you going to get there? Well, we're driving. Oh, you're driving. Oh, okay. Well, you're good. Have fun with that, you know. And because it's really difficult. It takes about 24 hours, and usually you break it up over 2 days. So you bring your iPads and your devices and everything, and you sit in there in the car, in an air-conditioned car with your family and all the luxuries in the world, and you've got all these nice rest stops along the way, and you can stop at a nice hotel to sleep overnight. But still, ladies, if you've been pregnant, what would it take for you to have to take that journey to Florida in your third trimester? Probably a lot. And that would be a 2-day journey. We're talking a 4-day journey where Joseph was probably walking and Mary was probably on the back of a donkey. The circumstances of her pregnancy probably would have deprived her of all friends. So it's as if she's saying to Joseph, you are the only one who's with me on this. And there's no way I'm going to let you leave me behind. No matter how difficult this journey was going to be, she was going to take it. Right before my daughter Mia was born, the day she was born, actually, the day before she was born, that morning my wife had started having contractions, and they weren't that severe. They were kind of random. And so it looked like we were still in good shape. And I went to work, and then after work, I had a softball game, and we were in the playoffs. So I found myself in a really difficult situation, and it was an away game in Lindenhurst. And we would have had to travel during rush hour. So I'm trying to figure out what to do here, and I talked to Allie, and I'm thinking, okay, what do we do? So we put our heads together, and we made a decision, and looking back, it was probably the worst possible decision we could have made. But we decide that, yes, I'm going to play in this game, and I'm going to bring her. So we're going to drive to Lindenhurst during rush hour for this softball game. And we took Sunrise Highway, which my wife now calls Speed Bump Parkway. Because you know if you've been on the highway, it's like ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. And it was like, now I don't know all the details of how pregnancy is, you know, how you get closer to the time or whatever, but it was like everything sped up times 100 as soon as we got on the road. And as soon as we pulled in, I got out of the car, started putting on my cleats, looked over, saw my teammates, and Allie said, we've got to go back home. So we turned around, we went back home, we rode Speed Bump Parkway all the way back. But that for me was extremely stressful. Because I didn't know what was going to happen, if at some moment Allie was going to have to give birth, or what the deal was. I'm a first-time father, and this is a 45-minute drive across Long Island with cars and people and hospitals everywhere. They're walking 80 miles, 4 days through the wilderness. It would have been a terrible, terrible, terrible journey. And yet she decides to go, because things were that bad where she was. It's scary, it's cold, and it's dangerous. Well, right as they arrive into Bethlehem, it's time for Jesus decides he's going to enter the world, right, at that moment. And I just imagine, right, as they're approaching Bethlehem, Mary's having contractions, and Joseph is starting to sweat, and he's pulling the donkey, and he's saying, look, I promise you there's an inn right up there. We're almost there. We're almost there. And he's trying to talk her through this. And eventually they get to the inn, and there we meet the worst person who has ever lived. This innkeeper who apparently has the audacity to look at this young, desperate couple, this couple who has no plan, nowhere to go, who's about to give birth, and he says, sorry, there's no room. Pretty sure the rule is that you make room in that situation. You know, in the Bible, this is really only one or two sentences. It tells us just very briefly what happened. And I'm totally convinced that the reason that the conversation between the innkeeper and Joseph isn't there is because Joseph's response would have been way too inappropriate to put in the Bible. So here they are. She's about to give birth. Okay? And we, you know, we know that she gave birth in some type of stable or barn or cave or whatever it may be. But they didn't. You know, in my mind, maybe you're like this, but I always thought it was like, okay, journey to Bethlehem and here's a stable and let's set up and get everything nice. And but it wasn't like that. They still now, with her about to give birth, they don't know where they're going to go. So it's like they just drop whatever they have and say, okay, here's some shelter. I guess we have to do it here. And they find themselves in, we don't know, it may have been a barn, it may have been a cave, but they're animals, and that's where it's going to happen. That's where the God of the universe, who decides to become a man, is going to enter the world. This is his grand entrance. And there Joseph probably has to deliver Jesus. Mary probably would have been on the ground in this place that animals lived. It was less than ideal. It was not perfect. It wasn't pretty. And this is how God comes into the world. It is a crazy, crazy story. And there, the couple, remember, they just finished an 80-mile journey. Okay, 80 miles. I've never gone that far on foot. Seems like a really long distance. And then right after that, she's got to give birth. And Joseph's got to try and make this happen. And he does. And I imagine the couple, with nothing left, with no energy, they need a break. They need to take a nap, to rest. So what do? They wrap the baby in cloth, look around, and they put him in the only place that they can. They take the baby and they put him in an old, dirty bucket. No, they didn't put him in a bucket. Chances are when I said bucket, you probably thought, oh, why do you say that? That's weird. You don't put babies in buckets. Well, if I would have, we've heard the word manger, that Jesus was placed in a manger so many times that we've come to think that it's normal. But in the same way, you don't put a baby in a bucket, you don't put a baby in a manger. But that was their only option. So they lay the God of the universe, who became a baby in a feeding trough. I imagine that Joseph, looking around with his exhausted wife, he can't keep his eyes open, so he walks over, pushes some animals out of the way, drags over the thing that they're eating out of, cleans it out the best that he can, and just says, okay, I guess this is where we're going to have to put the baby. They didn't put him there so that, you know, it would look really nice on our greeting cards. It probably wasn't glowing. It was less than ideal. It was the way it was. And that's the way that God makes his grand entrance. That's the way that God enters the world. It's a crazy story. And then the story goes on to get even a little bit crazier. They're visited by shepherds. Now, in most of our nativity scenes, the shepherds, they look like, you know, these cute little teenage boys usually holding a baby lamb, you know, but the job of a shepherd was a really difficult, difficult job. If you owned sheep and this was your property, they didn't have banks back then, they didn't have funds, they didn't have, you know, only the really wealthy could put their money away in banks, but really what you had was what you own. So your flock would have been the equivalent to like your investment or your life savings or your retirement. This would have been like all you had for so many people. And you only have a certain amount of land, and eventually your land can no longer feed the sheep that you have. So you have to send your sheep out into the country to go eat. And you've got other things to do, so you hire someone. You hire a shepherd. And the shepherd would take your sheep out into different parts of the region so that the sheep could eat. Now, the shepherd had to protect those sheep. He had to protect them from wolves. He had to protect them from lions, from bears. If a thief comes along that's bigger and stronger than your shepherd, you've just lost everything you own. So these shepherds were these pretty rough and tough characters. You know, you would want somebody who could fight, who could fend for themselves, somebody who could survive out in the wilderness to be a shepherd. And these shepherds are the ones that come and visit Mary, which is great. It's nice that, you know, they were there, but they're not her family members. They're not Joseph's family members. They're not her friends. They're just shepherds. And it's interesting. You can read from the text, you know why they were invited? It's a really deep spiritual theological meaning. It says, there were shepherds out in the fields nearby. They were around. So they got invited. Now there might be some symbolism there, as you know, Jesus as the good shepherd, that it may go deeper than that, but at the time of Mary's birth, she doesn't know this. And all of a sudden these shepherds show up. You know, I don't know, if it were me, I'd be like, oh, who are you? You know, when my daughter was born, you had to buzz in and we had to let you come into the room. And these shepherds, they show up on the scene. It's a crazy, crazy story. And then Pastor Josh, he's on Christmas Eve, he talked about these people we call the Magi or the wise men. Now, there weren't three of them. There could have been many of them. And they didn't come the night of Jesus' birth. They actually came days later. But for the sake of our nativity scene, they show up, and these magi, Jewish people did not like magi, typically, because the things that they did were a little bit sketchy. They were astrologers. They were sorcerers. The things that they did were outside of the comfort zone of the average Jewish person. So a devout Jew at that time, which Mary and Joseph were, it would have been a little bit weird to have these magi come and give them gifts, but these are the people that show up. It's not the Pharisees, it's not the religious teachers, it's the magi. These strangers, these sorcerers, people that were unwelcome typically in Jewish society. They're the people that visit Jesus. It's just a crazy story on so many levels. So here we have our nativity scene, right? We'll include the Magi. We'll let them be there, even though they weren't really there on that night. You've got this young couple whose reputations are both totally ruined. They're outcast now, at least from the people that know them and their story. You've got Jesus, the King of the world, wrapped in cloth, lying in a manger, which is crazy in itself, in a feeding trough that animals eat out of. You've got these shepherds that Mary and Joseph don't know. And then you've got these animals that are just around. Have you ever thought about how insulting it is that there are animals in your nativity scene? Now I love animals, and if you're an animal lover, I'm not trying to insult you, but they're there taking up space. They're a reminder that nobody else was there. When God became flesh and became one of us insignificant people, there should have been crowds. There should have been all these people that were waiting supposedly for the Messiah to welcome him. Their family members should have been there. The friends should have been there. We shouldn't be able to fit our little nativities under Christmas trees. They should be huge. And yet we have animals in there because nobody else showed up. It's insulting. And this is how the king of the world comes to earth. It's crazy. It's crazy. It would be like at your wedding, you know, imagine having the guy who plays the organ and the pastor and the wedding planner and the ushers in all your wedding pictures. There's nothing wrong with them. They're all great people, I'm sure. But that's not who's in your pictures. Probably it's your family members. It's your friends. It's the people that have been waiting to celebrate with you. If those other people were there, the organ player and the officiants, and whatever, it would just be a reminder, a painful reminder that nobody else showed up. And that's what we see here with our nativity story. If nothing else, when you look at your nativity, it should be a reminder to you and to me that Jesus came to a world that didn't want him. Though we needed him desperately, we didn't want him. Nobody showed up. The whole story from beginning to end is just absolutely crazy. You couldn't make it up. Mary, she deserved to be honored. Said she was an outcast. Jesus, he deserved to be born in a palace. Instead, he was placed in a manger. He couldn't even get a room at an inn. He couldn't even get a roof over his head. He deserved a welcome party, a celebration. Instead, he was visited by a couple shepherds. The story deserves to be a story of elegance, of abundance, of joy, of fulfilled anticipation and expectation. Instead, it's a dangerous tale of survival. And this is the story of how God came to earth. This is his grand entrance. Jesus came for a world that didn't want him. Well, tragically, the story gets worse before it gets any better. We meet a guy, his name is Herod. He's a king. And Pastor Josh talked a little bit about him recently. In case you weren't here, in case you forgot, Herod had a pretty crazy resume. Anybody that even came close to threatening his throne, he did away with them. There was a high priest in Israel at that time that was very popular with people. And Herod didn't like it. So coincidentally, this high priest had a drowning accident in just a few feet of water. Herod had his own wife strangled. Herod killed two of his own sons. These people that were one day going to take his throne, he had them killed. He didn't like the idea of that. On his deathbed, he had another one of his sons killed. This guy was crazy. And probably the craziest thing of all that he did, you see, he knew that people didn't like him. So on his deathbed, he arranged for some, we might call them local celebrities, but they were nobles in the land of Israel. People that were very popular, the people that the community loved. He had them all arrested, taken away, and they were set aside to be killed the moment that Herod died. Why? Because he wanted the nation of Israel to mourn when he died, even if it wasn't for him. That's how crazy this guy was. He was known as the king of the Jews. He was appointed by Caesar to be their king. And he took pride in that title. So if you know the story, you know that those magi I mentioned earlier, when they were looking for Jesus, they approached Herod, and they said, "Where is this king of the Jews?" And knowing Herod, you know his blood began to boil when he heard that. What do you mean somebody who's king of the Jews has just been born? So he tells them, he says, "Go find them, find this king of the Jews and bring him to me so I can worship him." But we know he's not going to worship him. And the Magi, they're warned in a dream not to return back to Herod because God knows what Herod wants to do. So Herod, feeling outwitted, he decides that he's going to have every boy in Bethlehem under the age of 2 killed. How heartless do you have to be to kill a 2-year-old? And here we have hundreds of baby boys being killed because this man felt threatened. And this is all, let me remind you, the story of how God entered the world to come to save the world. And this is the welcome party he's received. It would have been more appropriate for Herod to say, oh, you know what, I don't know where the king is, so I'm going to give all these 2-year-old boys a crown just to make sure that the one who deserves it gets it. That would have been appropriate. But instead he orders that they're killed because he felt threatened. Fortunately, Joseph and Mary, if you know the story, you know that they're warned again to get out of Bethlehem. So Jesus' life is spared. But those other boys all died. And here we have Mary and Joseph. When you think things can't get any worse, they're on the run. They're being hunted. It's a crazy story. It's a dangerous tale. And what I want you to see, the point that I'm trying to make, especially with this passage about Herod, I believe that what Matthew wants us to see, this is where he ends the story of Jesus' childhood. What he wants us to see about the childhood of Jesus, about the big picture of the Christmas story. Herod's massacre is the resounding exclamation point to the message of the Christmas story that says Jesus came for a world that didn't want him. No thanks. Not interested. In case you missed it with the whole birth in a barn thing, here's a king who does everything in his power to make sure Jesus doesn't see his third birthday. This is the world that Jesus came to save. In John 1, John writes about Jesus. He says, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world didn't recognize him. He says he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. In Isaiah 53, again talking about Jesus, Isaiah prophesies and says, he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering, familiar with pain. He's talking about God who became one of us to save us. It's crazy. And then, you know, I'd like to say after that everything was just, you know, sunshine and rainbows, but things just continued. That same whatever. They continued to treat Jesus in a way he didn't deserve. He would be mocked, he would be doubted, he would be abandoned, he'd be rejected, he'd be betrayed. Some would believe in him, but most wouldn't. They'd make up lies about him, and eventually they would kill him. And this is the story of God becoming a man for us. Some welcome party. Some way to treat the God who became man, Emmanuel. And here's the mind-blowing story, the mind-blowing part of the story that I've hinted at already. But just take a second to comprehend this. Do you know who he came to? Who Jesus came for? Who he came to save? He came for the people that scorned his mother and father. He came for the innkeeper that had no room for him at the inn. He came to save the king Herod, who wanted to make sure that he wouldn't grow up. He came to save the people that accused him of being demon-possessed. He came to save the Pharisees and the teachers who would later try and make a fool out of him in front of everybody. He came to save Judas, who betrayed him. He came to save Peter, who denied him. He came to save the guards who arrested him. He came to save the soldiers who beat him. He came to save the people who spat in his face. He came to save the man named Pilate, who handed him over to the crowds. He came to save those crowds that shouted, "Crucify him." The people that chose a murderer named Barabbas over him. He came to save the very men who nailed him to the cross. He came to save the people that didn't want him. No thanks. Not interested. And in the midst of all this, it wasn't like a one-time thing. This was a lifestyle that Jesus lived of being mistreated. Through all of this, in the midst of it, no matter what we would throw at him, with unwavering persistence and undying determination, it's like he says, I'm here and I'm going to do it anyway because I love you. Nothing could stop him from doing what he came to do, no matter how we treated him. And that's what we call unfailing love. And in light of that, you know, John writes in one of his letters, this is how we know what love is. Because of the love that Jesus showed us. Not that we loved him, but that he loved us. Not just, you know, in a feel-good type of love way, but in a you can treat me as terribly as you want, and I'm not going to stop loving you kind of way. That's the kind of God that we have. He never once got what he deserved. And it never once stopped him from doing what he came to do. It's amazing. And here we cross over now to 2015, to today. Because it's easy to look at those people and go, oh, how could they do that? But I think that this still goes on in our own lives. I think that there's a little Herod, a little King Herod in all of us, in our hearts. We've got these areas of our lives that each, it's like each one has a throne. And in some, if you consider yourself a Christian or a church person or whatever, we've got Jesus on the throne in some areas of our lives. Like maybe you let Jesus call the shots with your time. And you're great with how you spend your time serving and volunteering and all that, but then it comes to how you speak. And there, the little King Herod inside of you says, well, no, I'm still on the throne in that area of my life. Jesus isn't calling the shots in the way that I speak to my wife. Jesus isn't calling the shots in the way that I speak to my kids or my friends or the way I talk about that girl that I really don't like. Or the way I talk about whoever. Who's calling the shots in those areas of your life? Who's calling the shots in the area of your finances? That's what I mean by sitting on the throne, the one who is calling the shots. And if you can say in those areas of your life, God, I'll do what you want me to do to the best that I know how, then Jesus is on the throne there. And what's amazing is that in each area of our lives, whether it's, you know, our work life, the business life, our home life, life as a parent, life as a spouse, life as a friend, life as a sibling, whatever it is, in all those areas of our lives, just like this world that Jesus came to save, we desperately need him, and there's something inside us that doesn't want him. And if in those moments we can kick the little Herod off the throne, it'll be so much better for us. Or maybe for you, it's more of a big picture type thing. You know, maybe you are on the throne of your life in every area, which we all were. If you are a Christian, there was a time in your life where you were not, I'm sure. And maybe you're in that position today where you're on the throne and you're obviously Jesus is not the one calling the shots. And you know deep down that your life is lacking meaning and purpose. And deep down, though you may not articulate it, you know that you are desperate for something, or we would say someone. But part of you doesn't want it. And that's natural. All of us face that. But maybe today is the day where you push that little King Herod where you win the battle for the throne and let Jesus sit where he deserves to sit. And if that's a decision you want to make, I would encourage you to find somebody you know who's a strong believer and talk to them about it and find out what that means, or come talk to a pastor or come talk to somebody about it. And just say, I want to put Jesus on the throne of my life. I want to know him. God wants to know you more than you want to know him. He loves you like crazy. And if you do it, it'll be the best decision that you ever make. As hard as it may be, as loud as that voice that doesn't want it may be, it'll be the best thing that you ever do. So, as I close, my hope is that we'll look at this Christmas story as crazy as it is, and we'll take Jesus, the Jesus who was put in a manger, and we'll put him on the throne that he deserves to be on in every area of our lives. Let's pray. God, you are good beyond our comprehension. And there are times in all of our lives, including my own life, when I know that I believe the lie that you don't want what's best for me, that I should be the one who calls the shots. But will you help all of us to understand what Paul tried to explain in Romans when he basically said, if he loves you enough to die for you, he loves you enough to be trusted. Lord, would you let that sink deep into our hearts and change us and do what only you can do in us? I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.